Hello and welcome to this edition of the Golf Channel Podcast with Rex and Lav. We get to Ben Coles and the unfortunate happenings of a 72nd hole when trying to win a golf tournament on the PGA Tour. Rex, I know that is exactly where you are in Dallas, but first, we have to get to something that is much further away. In Singapore, Brooks Koepka is back in the winner's circle, the first one on LIV to get four career wins on the Saudi-backed circuit. This one, Rex, I thought was an important one. In his last start for his title defense at the PGA Championship, wins by a handful of shots in Singapore, and it ended a stretch of what was some pretty pedestrian golf, at least by Brooks Koepka's high standards. How meaningful do you think it was that he is once again a winner?
I do want to talk about Brooks because I did spend some time today looking into it because I was really, really curious. Two things I wanted to touch on. One, what's going on with your shirt? What's happening here?
Happy Cinco de Mayo to all who celebrate.
Sure. Do you have a Cinco de Mayo party going on at your house? What's happening?
We had a little get together. This was just part of an ensemble. I also had a custom made fedora that I was wearing while drinking some Dos Equis earlier. So it's a whole vibe.
That's the one you got from Puerto Rico, right?
Exactly. It looks utterly ridiculous right now as a standalone. As I'm looking now into our StreamYard record and seeing it on camera, people are going to be pretty confused, especially when this posts on Monday, May 6th. But that's the backstory, is that we had a Cinco de Mayo party, and this was a vibe.
I felt like I had to clean that up. And secondly, you have a mea culpa here. You don't even realize it, but you defamed, you drug one of the greatest minds on the PGA Tour through the mud this week, and that's Stuart Williams. He's the PGA Tour meteorologist. He told me earlier in the week, oh, we'll be fine. Like, and look, Stuart has been through thick and thin. He knows exactly what he's talking about. I tried to tell you everything was going to be fine, but you went straight to, nope, Tuesday finish. You're never getting out of there. You might as well move to Dallas. It's going to be flooding. It's going to be mayhem. It's going to be terrible. And yet we finished up. So I'll go ahead and wait. I'll hang up and wait for your mea culpa.
I'm not the one who brought a PGA Tour player on live television to say how bad the forecast was. You're the one who brought Ben Griffin onto the set of your Golf Today hit and had him basically reading the forecast, which was 10 shades of awful, as well as explaining exactly what was going to be happening atmospherically. So in hindsight, this looks terrible. They moved up tee times on Sunday for the final round. There was no precipitation. It rained, obviously, a lot overnight, played lift clean in place for the final round. But everything was on schedule. Everything finished Sunday night. You don't have a Tuesday finish. In fact, you could be coming to Pinehurst for the U.S. Open Media Day to join me had you hopped on a flight on Sunday evening out of Big D.
Not sure I could do that. Not with Delta. However, I will say this, and to your point, I actually liked the Ben Griffin segment because I thought he leaned into it, which we always want from PGA Tour players. We want to see more personality, and here's an opportunity for us to see it. And I thought he did a really cool job. It was funny. I was teasing with him the next day, like, you're fired. I told him because you got the forecast wrong, and he didn't.
He's think hired.
That was funny.
If anything, he's hired. He goes like 50%.
Yeah. And he goes, no, he goes, actually, I did that just so I wouldn't, because he had an early tee time. And he goes, actually, I did that so I didn't have to deal with the weather. We had one hour weather delay this week. And you're right. We got a lot of rain overnight. Pretty much every night it rained. But throughout the course of the week, it was fine. To Brooks Koepka, no apology for Stuart Williams at all. Like, you're just going to gloss over this.
This was his forecast that I was basing my doom and gloom outlook for. No.
But no, he told me.
I wasn't doing my own modeling. I wasn't looking at the forecast. I wasn't working my sources in the meteorology world. I was taking Stuart Williams at his word that this was what's going to happen over the course of 4 days.
Stuart, you're a hero. Keep it up. Like, I'm sorry that you have to be defamed in this particular situation. Brooks is fascinating. And look, I was in Dallas. I was at the CJ Cup, Byron Nelson. Ooh, had a hard time with that. And clearly I was paying attention to that tournament, and we'll get to it. However, like, the Brooks thing fascinates me because this feels like last year when he won in Orlando at the LIV event in Orlando at Orange County National, going into the Masters, and it had been a minute since he had done anything, and suddenly he just flipped that switch. And I think I actually said this a few weeks ago after the Masters that, oh, of course he's going to flip the switch. Like, we're in major championship season. We're going to see major Brooks, and that's what's going to happen. And suddenly he's going to suddenly snap to and play some of his best golf. And he didn't do it at the Masters. I think he talked about it this week and called it embarrassing. what happened at the Masters. And I'm really, really looking forward to what's going to happen at Valhalla at the PGA Championship in 2 weeks, because suddenly he looks like Brooks. And it is an amazing transformation. I don't know that I've ever seen a player been able to do this. Look, Tiger Woods in his prime, he was great week in and week out. It didn't matter if it was a major or if it was the Honda Classic. He was really, really good regardless. He was going to play well. He was going to contend. That was what he did best. Brooks is fascinating to me because he can flip the switch. And now all of a sudden he did it in a very pivotal moment over the course of the season where he said he's embarrassed. He didn't like what happened at the Masters. And you look at Valhalla and you think, well, yeah, of course, Brooks. Brooks being Brooks, maximum Brooks, he can contend there. So I even went on Datagolf, which you're always talking about, and I was really curious. So I kind of started combing through some of the stats because my go-to is we don't understand because we don't have the analytics on LIV Golf that we have on the PGA Tour. Actually, you do on Datagolf, to be fair. And he gained like 5 strokes on the field off the tee and 3 strokes on the greens. Like the things he's doing right now is Brooks at his best.
As part of the question and answer session on Wednesday in LIV Singapore, he was asked, how do you feel your game is trending to defend his title at the PGA Championship? He said, quote, clearly not very good with Augusta the way that it went. This is, to me, the most telling one. I kind of felt like I wasted all that time from December until then. Just keep grinding away, keep doing the work, and hopefully something will turn around. Again, that was 5-6 days ago, where Brooks Koepka is pretty pessimistic. Now, in hindsight, with the trophy sitting alongside him, he said, look, I shot back-to-back rounds at 600 par in the second and third rounds at LIV Adelaide. Like, I clearly found something. He said, I think he makes it a little bit more simplistic than it actually is, but he said it always comes down to fundamentals. It's a ball position thing. He played a lot in the wind early part of the year. The ball drifts back. He has a two-way miss going, and he's very particular with, he likes to see his shots come out of a window and hit a fade. When he doesn't do that, he really doesn't know where the ball is going. And I think that's what you saw from the results. I mean, he has not done much of anything really since last year's PGA Championship. There has not been, you know, any phenomenal finish. Certainly in 2024, he's gotten off to a very sluggish start. The Masters, which he referenced, as he called embarrassing, was a tie for 45th. And so, he called it a good wake-up call, and I think that's the exactly what it was. He said he didn't want to have to apologize to his team once again for playing like that. You know, he's put in a lot of work. He thought he was turning the corner, and now he actually has a result that he can reference. To me, I think this automatically vaults him back into the conversation of who can challenge Scottie Scheffler. PGA Championship has been, I think, Brooks Koepka's kindest major championship. We look at how he's performed over the past 4 or 5 years, seemingly always has a shot to win that golf tournament the way it's now set up under Kerry Hague. I don't see any reason why Valhalla will be different this year.
And I think I went straight to the idea that when Brooks is at his best, you're right, he can challenge Scotty. And I don't know that there's anyone else in the game right now that could do that. We're going to look to Rory, and he's going back to Valhalla where he won the PGA Championship last time we were there. And clearly that's going to be part of the narrative. But it's got to be a 1 and a 1A, right? I mean, there's no other way around it going into the PGA Championship.
No. I mean, Scotty's 1. We're talking.
Well, yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah.
No, I feel almost like Brooks at this point, and maybe this is overstating it and being a prisoner of the moment, but I feel like he's 1A right behind 1, which would be Scotty. Like, you're right. Like, Scotty is going to be right there, and he's not playing next week at the Wells Fargo waiting for the birth of his first child, which you totally understand. But I would put Brooks a 1A. Like, I don't even know if there's anyone, like, whoever's going to be second, and we can debate that when the time comes. I don't think it's even necessarily close at this point.
Like, who do you trust at a PGA Championship more, Roy McIlroy or Brooks Koepka?
Brooks. Right now, with the way with what we've seen, like, and this is no disrespect to Rory, and there's a lot of things going on in his life right now, but you are what your record says you are. And in this particular case, he's not 1A in this situation. It would be Brooks because he was able to flip the switch. And I'm going to be the first one to say it. Like, I will do my mea culpa on this one. After the Masters, and I think maybe even before the Masters, I kind of scoffed at the idea that, oh, flip the switch. Like, it's that easy. Like, he's really just going to decide, okay, I haven't played well at all. And suddenly, in this particular situation at the Masters, I'm going to be able to pull it off. I do think it's interesting. And look, we can dissect this and we'll continue to do it. And certainly how toxic social media is going to have a say in this as well. But I'm not quite sure if the live schedule is the best way for these players to get ready for major championships. And I don't mean that as knock against.
What have you possibly seen that would suggest that it's not?
Because in this particular case, and Brooks even said it today, or said it on Sunday when he was talking about the win, he wanted to make the putt on 18, not necessarily the win, to make sure his team, I think they were in third, wherever they ended up finishing. So it's just a different scenario. And the cadence is different, and you're not playing what you're normally used to playing. And I'm not even saying it's necessarily bad. I mean, I think time will tell, where there is an argument to be made that maybe playing less going into the biggest events is better for you. I think Tiger Woods is probably a really good example of this, but it's just a different, it's just a different way to get ready than what we've seen historically. And I think some players, John Rahm probably being the primary example, have struggled with that.
I think it's very much TBD exactly how the majors are going to unfold in 2024 for John Rahm. I mean, he plays a lot of golf typically on the PGA Tour, 20, 22, 23 times, likes to play his way into major form. Obviously, he did not play his best at the Masters. I don't think he's playing his best at all in 2024 from what we've seen, certainly with the strokes gained metrics as well. I actually think LIV Golf is perfect for Brooks Koepka and has been a very beneficial move for his career. First of all, he got the bag at a time in his career when he was very uncertain short-term what his injury history was going to look like, what his short-term future was going to look like on the PGA Tour. Go ahead and get your money. We're not here to look at anyone's pockets. Second of all, it allowed him with a longer offseason in the start to the next year to rehab the injuries that had plagued him for the past couple of years in the PGA Tour, whether it was hip, whether it was knee. Those were nagging injuries that were costing him. And when you feel like you have to continually play, whether it's to get ready for a major championship, whether it's to get ready for the FedEx Cup playoffs, whether it's to get ready for a President's Cup, a Ryder Cup, whatever the case may be, there's just no time. It just feels like you're constantly chasing. So I think it was beneficial in that respect. But I think the biggest one, I think what we've seen now, particularly with this latest victory at LIV Singapore, is Brooks Koepka has never cared about regular season golf. He's not motivated by the history of regular tournaments, whether it's the Memorial, whether it's Bay Hill, whether it's Riviera. They are merely precursors to major championships. How many times has he said, Brooks Koepka, over the course of his career, no one knows how many PGA Tour wins you've earned. It's how many major championships. So these are just warm-up events for him. Would he have liked to play better than 45th? Yeah, he said as much, that it's not fun to go out and try and get internally motivated, even externally motivated, when you're that far down the leaderboard. He likes to be in the mix. However, these sorts of tune-ups, this is what he's trying to go out there for. He wants to see his ball striking improve. He wants to see how he handles himself under pressure. He wants to play the smart, strategic, punishing golf that we have seen over the major championships, where it's very calculating. He was able to do that in Singapore, and that's why I think this move has been so beneficial for him. It's never been about regular season golf. It's all sort of preseason until the spotlight and the showcase. It is amazing, and we've seen it now for 5-6 years, how he can flip the switch. I can't think of anyone in the game's long history who can be so pedestrian for so long and then look utterly unbeatable at a time when you're supposed to perform your best. Like, it's an amazing characteristic, and I'm sure every top player, Scotty, Rahm, Rory, Victor, would kill for that, to be able to shine, to be able to shine the brightest when the lights are absolutely the most intense.
No, it's a trait that I don't think anyone else has ever had in the history of the game. Because you look at Jack Nicklaus, you look at Tiger Woods, you look at Tom Watson, Phil Mickelson, you can keep going down the list. I mean, if you performed well in the biggest events, you also performed well in those other events that were the second tier, which would be every other PGA Tour event. You've never had a player like this that not only did it, but it like openly flaunted the idea that the Phoenix Open really didn't interest me, which in Brooks's case, that's probably the only one that did interest him of the non-major championships. But we've never seen this before. And I'm fascinated by the idea that in the biggest events, when the pressure is the most, and this is going to sort of track back to the CJ Cup, that's when he seems to be most relaxed. And it doesn't make sense, because what we know about major championship golf is every shot is just the intense pressure cooker of trying to win a major championship. And that's what he thrives on. And I don't even know, Tiger Woods had that gear certainly in every event, but it's not as though he dismissed it everywhere else except for the majors. Because look, the majors were clearly the most important thing to Tiger Woods. It was Jack Nicklaus's record he had on the wall, not Byron Nelson's record that he had on the, or I'm sorry, Sam Snead's record that he had on the wall growing up. But he still performed. He still won, you know, 80 something times on the PGA Tour. To me, that's fascinating.
He said afterward on Sunday, Brooks Koepka did, that what separates him is his ability to lock in and go someplace where I think a lot of guys can't go. We've talked so much about Roy McIlroy and the majorless drought he has and how he twists himself into a pretzel before each and every major championship. And once again, ahead of the Masters, he tried something different. Like, Brooks knows exactly what works. He never wavers from it and has tons of confidence. I think it's even more reason to be bullish about Brooks Koepka heading into Valhalla when you look at how these tournaments have been set up ever since the move back to May. We're not going to see a 16 under par win the PGA Championship of Valhalla like we saw in August in 2014 when it was last played there. Kerry Haig has now put his imprint on this tournament, where the last couple times it's been in May, 9 under par or worse has been the winning score. That's exactly Brooks Koepka golf, where you grind out a 69, a 70, a 71. You don't make double bogeys. You play to the smart side. It's very tough, smash mouth style of golf. That's what Brooks Koepka does best. I think he will be very difficult to beat in his title defense. Rex, how about the tournament that you just covered? CJ Cup, Byron Nelson. I don't think it will be particularly memorable. I don't think anyone, December 31st, when we're doing end of season podcasts, will immediately cite the happenings at TBC Craig Ranch. But it is Taylor Pendrith who walked away and became a first-time PGA Tour winner. What was your takeaway from the day that was at the Nelson?
You're right. We won't at the end of the year. I will say, watching those last three holes, that's probably three of the most entertaining holes I've watched all season long. And look, take the names out of it. Like, if I told you it was going to be Rory McIlroy and Brooks Koepka doing this over the last three holes, everyone would be like, oh, this is fantastic. This is the best thing that's ever happened. But because it was Pendrith and because it was Coles, it's probably going to go largely unnoticed. But consider the scenario that Coles birdies 16 and 17 to take a one shot lead. And look, he hit some amazing shots on 16 and 17. And Pendrith hits the ball a mile. So you know he's going to birdie the par 5 18th hole. You know what's in store. Maybe he's thinking eagle. What you didn't think is that there was going to be that big of a swing where Coles isn't able to make par. He ends up making bogey.
On a par 5, on a reachable par 5, you had a two-shot swing. That was completely unexpected.
Well, and I'm going to do the cheesy sports radio thing right now. Because, and look, I did the winner's interview, and then afterwards I did the runner-up interview because he wanted to be in the locker room. Coles wanted to stay in the locker room for a couple of minutes and collect himself. And he was fine. I encourage everyone to watch Golf Central tonight and watch. But like, the question I asked him was, and this is going to come down to his second shot, ended up in a really weird spot. He kind of got a little unlucky. He was between two bunkers short of the green. He'd been better off in either one of those bunkers, because then you can put some spin on the ball and it's a much easier shot. But he was in the rough, and the way he kind of explained it to me is, I hadn't been in the rough chipping really all week long. He'd hit the ball really, really well if you look at his stats. But I asked him specifically, it's always weird when you're talking to someone who's just sort of done what he did on the 18th hole and essentially collapsed, but what were your options on 18? And his immediate reaction was, oh, I hit the shot I wanted to. And I didn't have a very good face filter during the interview, because I sort of looked at him like, really? That's the shot you wanted to hit? Because what he did is he came up short, and he was lucky actually to give himself up.
He flubbed it.
Yeah, he chunked it, he flubbed it, whatever you want to call it. And look, it's sort of weird Bermuda. The golf course wasn't in the best condition this week, if I'm being honest. And he probably just got, you know, a little bit high on the club face, caught it, you know, however many grooves too high. The fact he even gave himself a putt for par is amazing. And look, he clearly whiffed that.
Amazing.
Amazing, because I thought the fourth shot was so much harder than the third shot. I mean, if you go back,
it was.
And it was, you're standing in the bunker. I think he was choked down all the way to the metal on the shaft, and he had to create something. And he gave himself 2-3 feet, whatever the case was, for par. It was almost a foregone conclusion that we were going to have a playoff. Like, I was already sort of looking it up, and all right, it's going to be 18, 18, 18, and then 10, and then this is what it's going to be. To miss that putt, it's breathless to me, but it was the third shot. And in that particular situation, it's, what are your options? And talk me through the degree of difficulty. And it was a really, really hard shot. But in that case, don't you have to play for par? And again, this is the cheesy sports radio thing, but I hate to second guess anyone in this situation, but he needed to play for par, no?
Yeah, I mean, it looks like thick Bermuda, clearly like some of the thickest rough on the entire golf course. The one mistake you cannot do is leaving it short. If nothing else, give a little oomph at the bottom of the swing, blast it 20 feet past, and give yourself a chance to make birdie, which would win the golf tournament. The one mistake you cannot do is flub it. And then he was in, as you mentioned, an impossible shot where he's digging his heels into the top of the bunker and just trying to squeeze it out to 5 or 6 feet to try and save par. I don't want to dismiss Taylor Pendrith, because I think this is obviously a hugely significant moment for him. It's great in a President's Cup year. It's a nice turnaround for a player who has had 3 non-surgical procedures on his shoulder, big hitter, but he had not played particularly well this spring. 5 missed cuts in 6 starts. It is pretty rare to see a player who went on the PGA Tour who was 140th in strokes gained tee to green. But look, this is great for Taylor Pendrith. To me, the story of this golf tournament is what happened to Ben Coles. And people love Rex. The people of this podcast love when we go behind the scenes. We give them the nitty-gritty, insidery golf stuff, where we're reporters and this is how we do our job. I'm always curious and fascinated to know, when you have a player who so clearly kicked away this golf tournament. I saw the word choke used on social media. I saw flub. I saw choke job. We're not going to get into that. How do you approach a subject who so clearly kicked away the golf tournament and make it so you're not being, I think, even more insensitive to him while also trying to be insightful for the viewer? How do you go about doing that?
You know, what's funny is our former boss, Jay Coffin, texted me right afterwards, just about the interview, just did some things. And the point of Jay that he made is he doesn't seem too beat up about this. And if you watch the interview on Golf Central, and I would encourage everyone to do that. And he was fine. Like, it's not as though he was sitting there in tears. So it wasn't as difficult as it possibly could have been. That said, is he probably spent 15 minutes in the locker room, and we were waiting, to the point that I thought that, wow, this isn't going to happen. And the idea was, he was inside the locker room with his agent. I think he wanted to call his wife. He wanted to talk it through. It's a really difficult situation, but you do need to talk to the media. And I'm not trying to be that media person that says that, oh, you always have to talk to us. No, that's not the case at all. But in this particular scenario, where you were in the final group, you had an opportunity to do something really special. And look, winning on the PGA Tour, I said it earlier this morning, winning on the PGA Tour is really hard. Winning on the PGA Tour for the first time is exceedingly difficult. Like, you can't get enough style points when you sit and you look at how difficult this may be. He was fine, not only with me in the interview with me, but he also did some quick quotes next to me, and he sort of wrapped his mind around it. There were no tears to drink. And I think this is what's a little bit different from other sports. In other sports, take basketball, for example, with the playoffs going on. The Orlando Magic lost today. My Orlando Magic lost today. And those are difficult.
Coughed up a big halftime lead.
Coughed up a huge halftime lead. And I actually watched some of those post-game interviews. And look, that's difficult because it's over. The season is done. You won't have an opportunity to do anything like this for a few months now. It's different. In the case of Coles, and look, it's difficult. You want to win on for the first time on the PGA Tour, but he immediately went to the idea that he got into next week's signature event, which is at Quail Hollow. He lives in North Carolina. It's really important to him. He has an opportunity now to try to get into the PGA Championship. Golf is weird like that, where you can look at the immediacy of the moment, and you can say, wow, you hit a bad shot. Like, you know, spill it. Give me your tears. I want to drink all of your tears right now. Or you can be like, I learned a lot. This was much better, this is where he went with me. I asked him specifically. He was in contention. He had a 2-stroke lead going in the final round at Puerto Rico last month, and he ended up shooting over par, terrible final round.
Yep.
And I said, how is this different than what you experienced in Puerto Rico?
And great question.
Thank you. I actually try sometimes. And his point was, I was so much better this time around. I was so much more relaxed. I was so much more composed. He did birdie 16 and 17 just to take the lead. It's not as though he just stumbled around all day long and found himself in a weird spot on the 18th hole. He did some stuff coming down the stretch that, if you're going to process this, and look, he's going to get on a plane tonight and fly home and probably spend a lot of time thinking about what happened. If you're going to process it, then yeah, you're going to go to the good stuff. You're going to go to, he hit his approach shot on 16 to 2 feet. Like, that is just lights out. You make a birdie on 17 when you feel like, wow, this could win me the tournament. I think those are the things he's going to focus on. He's not going to think about that bad chip shot.
Yeah, I mean, you and I have covered multiple sports, and we've all interviewed players who go ice cold in the fourth quarter of a basketball game and miss the critical shot, or they throw a game-clinching interception, you know, in the final 2 minutes, or the closer who serves up a home run in the bottom of the ninth. It's very difficult to ask those players who are in the heat of the moment questions. I think there's always like a division between, you know, we're not the ones who are in that arena, and you're asking someone to basically go through the worst part of their day. Like it's a pretty awkward dance. Golfers, however, to your point, they always seem to find silver linings easier, I think, than other athletes. Part of that, I think, is just the dynamics of tournament golf, where, as you mentioned, now Ben Coles is playing in 4 days at the Wells Fargo Championship. Like his season has just turned around pretty significantly. Second place money is also quite good for a player who has bounced back and forth between the Korn Ferry Tour and the PGA Tour for the majority of his career. This gives him a pretty significant leg up to try and keep his card now for 2025. And so when he's in the locker room, when he is processing that for 10, 15 minutes, as he did after the final round here, that is to me where his mind is going, where he's talking to his agent, he's talking to his wife, he's talking to a sports psych, he's talking to his best friend, whatever the case may be. I am sure they are planting those seeds of positivity in Ben Coles' mind. Like, hey, this sucks right now. I'm sure it stings a lot, but there was a lot to take from this week moving forward. I've always found that interesting with professional golfers and the concept of competitive golf compared to like a pitcher who then has to face his teammates. You know, it's all on him, as opposed to like the team dynamic. Do you feel that as well from kind of your past experience, the difference in team sport, individual sport, or even just the popularity of those sports?
No, it's a great point, because I think at the Ryder Cup, and you know, we saw it from Hunter Mahan a few years ago. I think it was the Celtic Manor Ryder Cup when he was just devastated. And like, he didn't lose the Ryder Cup that year, but what he did coming down the stretch, it wasn't very, very good golf, and like just gutted, and everyone around him tried to circle around him and give him support, but it's really, really difficult. And to your point, you're right. You lose so much more in golf, even Tiger Woods. Like, I don't know what his winning percentage was, but the greatest of all time, you could argue, won what, 20% of the time, 10% of the time. Like it just, you're always sort of trying to find.
But he almost always won, Rex, with the 54 hole lead, which is different. So he's closing out golf tournaments at a rate that we had never seen. The one that sticks out, of course, is the 09 PGA against Yang, where that's the tournament that he lost. And that was sort of the first kink in the armor, so to speak.
Well, and I remember asking Hank Haney when he was working with Tiger at the time about that phenomenon. But like, why is the 54 hole record so good? And it was so simple in Hank's mind. It's like, if he has the 54 hole lead, he's probably playing pretty well. And if Tiger Woods is playing pretty well, then everyone else is playing catch up, which made total sense to me. But as it applies to this particular case, and you're right, it's really, really difficult. I think professional golfers, more so than any other professional athletes, are really good at processing a loss, even a heartbreaking loss like this, because you have to be. I mean, what are you going to do? Beat yourself up every single week? Like, that's not a good way to live. That's a terrible lifestyle. I go back to, though, and he was on the broadcast with me this week, Terry Gannon. I've worked with him a couple times. But for those of you who don't know, Terry Gannon was on the North Carolina State basketball team that won the NCAA championship. The Valvano one, the one where, you know, do you believe in dreams?
Early 80s. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It was a long time ago, but it's a very famous moment. And in that moment, I remember him talking about this at a dinner a few years ago. If you watch, and I would encourage everyone to do this, if you watch that sort of last, whatever, 5 seconds of the game when they hit the game winner, Terry is over in the corner. He's spotted up just like you would be if you were, you know, a modern NBA player. And he has his hands up. And to hear him tell the story, it's, I had my hands up for a split second thinking that, yes, give me the ball. I'm wide open. I want to win this. And he goes, and then it dawned on me. Like, no, I don't want this. And he literally put his hands down. And I think that's such a telling moment where
not everyone's made to be the hero.
Nope. I don't want this. Where you have a player like Tiger Woods or Michael Jordan or
Brooks Koepka.
We can keep going down the list of GOATs. They want to be in that moment. 99% of the people in the world don't want to be in that moment.
Yeah. And I'm sure there was no lonelier place than the 72nd hole at the CJ Cup Byron Nelson when Ben Coles makes six and all he can do is watch Taylor Pendrith make a 2.5-3 footer to win his first golf tournament when 5-10 minutes earlier, it looked for all the world like at worst, Ben Coles was probably going to be in a playoff. And in all likelihood, if you saw the betting odds, he was a prohibitive favorite to go on and win his first PGA Tour event. Any other takeaways, Rex, from the week that was, whether it's Jordan Spieth, Will Zalatoris, this early week WD, looking ahead to Quail Hollow?
We got a lot of really, really good stuff this week when we asked for, I asked for stops on barbecue. I want to thank everybody who reached out to me. Hard Eight was very good. I thought it was great. I didn't have an opportunity to really do much else. I will say this, tonight, literally right next door to my hotel is a In-N-Out Burger. So I'm heading there right now.
Oh, that feels wrong to enjoy that in Texas and not before I board a red-eye flight, as I do typically every year from L.A., slam some In-N-Out, hop on a red-eye, pray for the people in 12A or 12B. I have a very eventful Monday and Tuesday lined up, Rex, at Pinehurst Resort. You and I did the boondoggle to end all boondoggles last year at this time. You and I played LACC, hopped on a private jet, and then played Pebble Beach, site of the U.S. Open and U.S. Women's Open, respectively. Last year, I'll be going solo this year, playing Pinehurst number two on Monday afternoon. Also supposed to be getting some time with reigning U.S. Open champion Wyndham Clark on Monday, so that will be great. And then the media day for Pinehurst number 10, which is supposed to be spectacular, is on Tuesday morning. So when we reconvene on Wednesday to do our preview edition of the Wells Fargo Championship, I should have plenty of fodder to bring the folks on what they can expect from this year's U.S. Open. Never played the golf course before. Really praying that I have enough golf balls. It has been all aboard the struggle bus of late, but I can't wait to get up to Pinehurst, North Carolina, early Monday morning. All right, that is going to do it for this edition. You got a sausage finger up? Go ahead, please.
I do. I wanted to pull back the curtain, but before you hit the record button, your comment to me was, how much water is there at Pinehurst? Which is not exactly a good frame of mind. You're not in a good spot.
No, I'm really not. I play with my wife 9 holes at our home course, Marsh Landing. And if you guys are familiar with Northeast Florida golf, actually Florida golf in general, like, it's pretty punishing. Where you if you miss the fairway, you're in the sand, you're in the water, you're in the marsh, you're in some sort of unplayable hazard. Like, it can be pretty claustrophobic at times. And so I've been playing a lot of steery golf, basically just playing away from big misses. My confidence is completely in the tank. My psyche has been broken. I've never played worse golf than I am right now. What better time to go to a U.S. Open venue, one that is notoriously difficult now with the wasty areas and the Turtleback greens, than right now? Like, it could be very ugly, but I'm just praying that the driver yips that I've since come down with do not rear its ugly head, because it has been very, very difficult. I will give a full report, though, on Wednesday. I do appreciate everyone's T's and P's, thoughts and prayers. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of Golf Channel Podcast with Rex and Lab. You guys know the drill. In the meantime, NBCSports.com/golf for the latest news, notes, and updates. We'll be back on Wednesday afternoon to rehash what will surely be a completely and utterly devastating mental round at both Pinehurst number 2 and Pinehurst number 10, as well as a preview of the Wells Fargo Championship, where all the top players in the PGA Tour in the field are there, except for, of course, world number 1, who, at least as of this recording, is still expecting his first child with wife Meredith. As always, thanks for listening. Thanks for the support. Talk to you guys on Wednesday.